This is again, this meeting is being recorded. If you do not wish to be recorded, you may disconnect at any time. This is a meeting of the duly noticed meeting of the Stakeholder Advisory Board. If you would like to speak, you can virtually raise your hand by pressing 5-star on your dial pad. You will then be called upon in the order that your hand was raised. Again, that's 5-star on your dial pad to ask a question by raising your hand. Please take a moment to enter your speaker code if you've not already done so. Please remember to mute your phones until speaking. Good afternoon and welcome to a duly noticed meeting for the Stakeholder Advisory Board to the Governor's Office of Emergency Relief and Recovery. The Governor's Office for Emergency Relief and Recovery was created when Governor Sununu issued Executive Order 2020-06. That order is publicly available on the Governor's website. Today's meeting is an official meeting of the Board, is open to the public, and will be run in a manner compliant with RSA 91A. We have someone on the phone taking minutes, which will be posted to the Gopher webpage. Meeting materials for the Board and the public can be found by visiting the Gopher webpage at www.gopherr.nh.gov. Again, that's www.gopherr.nh.gov. And again, this meeting today is being recorded. I will help facilitate today's meeting. Because the Board is meeting by phone, under RSA 91A, there are a few initial logistics that we need to do before I turn it over to Chair Donnelly Lozo. First, each of us must state our name, where we are located, and who is with us. As we move through our agenda today, each Board member and anyone else speaking is asked to identify themselves before speaking. Should you choose to take any votes today, they must be done by roll call. We'll now proceed with the attendance roll call, following this example. I am Joe Dorian, Deputy Director of the Gopher in the Gopher Office, 1 Eagle Square in Concord. With me are
Kate Giaquinto, Lisa English.
And we are all appropriately socially distanced in a large conference room at the Department of Business and Economic Affairs. Now we will proceed with Board members alphabetically. Bill Ardinger.
Hello, Joe and everybody. This is Bill Ardinger. I'm in my home in Concord, New Hampshire, and I'm alone. Thank you.
Thank you, Bill. Dean Kristen.
Good afternoon. This is Dean Kristen. I'm at my office in Bedford, and I am alone.
Thank you, Dean. Lisa Dravick.
Good afternoon, everyone. This is Lisa Dravick. I'm in my home office in Londonderry, and I am alone in the room.
Thank you, Lisa. Jim Jalbert.
Good afternoon, everyone. This is Jim Jalbert. I'm at my office in Portsmouth, New Hampshire, and I am alone.
Thank you, Jim. Amy LaBelle.
Hi, this is Amy LaBelle. I'm in my office at home, and I am alone.
Thank you, Amy. Al Letizio Jr.
Hi, everyone. This is Al Letizio Jr., and I am in my office in Windham, New Hampshire, alone.
Thank you, Al. Donnelly Lozo.
Afternoon. This is Donnelly Lozo, and I'm in my office in Manchester, and I'm alone.
Thank you, Donnelly. Scott Mason.
This is Scott Mason. I'm at my firm office in North Stratford, New Hampshire. I am alone.
Thank you, Scott. Michelle McEwen.
Good afternoon, everyone. This is Michelle McEwen. I am in my office in Plymouth, New Hampshire, and I'm alone.
Thank you, Michelle. Nancy Merrill.
Hi, this is Nancy Merrill, and I am at my work office in Claremont, and I am alone.
Thank you, Nancy. Jeffrey Myers.
Good afternoon. It's Jeff Myers. I'm at my home in Concord, and I am alone.
Thank you, Jeff. Holly Noveletsky.
Good afternoon. This is Holly Noveletsky. I'm in my office in Greenland, New Hampshire, and I'm alone.
Thank you, Holly. Kathleen Reardon.
Good afternoon. This is Kathleen Reardon. I'm in my home in New Boston, and I'm alone.
Thank you, Kathleen. Benjamin Wilcox.
Hi, everybody. This is Ben Wilcox. I am in North Conway in my office here at Cranmore, and I am alone.
Thank you, Ben. Donnelly, with the roll call completed, All board members are in attendance, and we are ready to continue.
Great. Thank you, Joe. Much appreciated. The next item on our agenda is going back your way, Joe, for a gopher presentation on updates from your shop, from the lab, and from the reopening task force.
Absolutely. I'm going to turn it over to Lisa English.
Wonderful. Thank you, Joe. So we don't have any specific updates just for gopher, but I do have a couple of updates from both lab and the reopening task force. So the Legislative Advisory Board met yesterday to complete the work it has been doing on a funding allocation proposal. And so that there's a cover letter describing that funding allocation proposal as well as the Excel spreadsheet that goes through proposed funding, proposed funding mechanisms, as well as a list of some of the other federal funding that have been received by industry or by governments to date. And so that's something that if we haven't been able to get to you yet, we will, as it gets finalized, we'll make sure that the Stakeholder Advisory Board has access to that and that it will be up on our website. I believe Legislative Advisory Board is not going to meet for the remainder of this week, but they do intend to meet, I believe, on Monday. Is that correct, Joe?
That is correct.
To talk about housing. So they're continuing their work, but at a different pace as they finish this first initial product that was talked about in the joint meeting on Friday. As far as the reopening task force, they are continuing their work as well. They're meeting today. And their discussion is their agenda and materials are on newhampshireeconomy.com/reopening task force. And they continue to work as a group on proposed guidance by industry. And according to the website for today, they're talking about guidance for massage, performing arts, childcare, lodging, attractions, health and fitness, and equestrian. That is all I have to report for today.
Great.
Thank you very much, Lisa. I appreciate it. The next item on our agenda are presentations for today, and I'd like to thank Michelle McEwen for organizing today's presentations and also her willingness to lead off after each presenter with the first question. So our first presenter today is Beth Slepian, President CEO of the Capital Region Visiting Nurse Association. And Beth, I am hoping I pronounced your last name properly. The floor is yours.
Hey, Donnelly, this is Joe. We're just trying to get Beth logged into the system. It appears to be, I guess, no surprise, a little slow today. So, Beth, if you wouldn't mind hitting 5-star for us so we can find you and unmute your line. Again, that's 5-star. Beth, I think we found you. Can you confirm that for us, please?
Yes, I can. This is Beth Slepian.
Thanks, Beth. Sorry for the technical difficulty.
Okay. So, good afternoon, members. Are you ready for me to begin?
Yes, we are. Thank you, Beth.
Okay. So, good afternoon, everyone. Thank you so much for inviting me to participate. My name is Beth Slepian. As mentioned, I am the president and CEO of Concord Regional VNA. As noted in my submitted comments, Concord Regional Visiting Nurse Association is a nonprofit Medicare-certified agency providing home health, hospice, palliative, private duty, senior health, and community health education in 44 towns in the Capital Region. We've been serving the community for 120 years. We have approximately 400 employees and cared for more than 7,300 patients in the community in 2019. Our senior health and community health education programs serve thousands more community members. I am a physical therapist by trade, and I have spent my entire 33-year career in New Hampshire, 26 of which in home health and hospice, and I have had the privilege for caring for individuals in their homes. So this pandemic has impacted our entire operation, from our staff to our patients and the greater communities that we serve. We've redesigned how we deliver care due to the impact in hospitals, as well as challenges faced by our workforce and fear of exposure by our patients. We also provided many senior health clinics and educational programs that had to be canceled. Our most vulnerable population is isolated, lonely, and potentially not seeking the care that they need. We continue to offer our home health hospice and private duty services and have adapted to the needs of our patients and our referral sources. At Concord Regional VNA, we have not reduced our workforce, but remained ready to meet the challenges that we face each day. We've also had more than 40 staff members volunteer to become trained to provide in-home testing for the state of New Hampshire, which brings us back to our roots of public health, and we're proud to serve. My peers and I in the home care and hospice industry in New Hampshire have accepted the challenge, acknowledged the importance of our services in caring for our community, and are committed to be part of the solution. Initially, the acquisition of PPE was all-encompassing. We've worked tirelessly with vendors and the state to acquire the necessary PPE to keep our staff safe. This was a challenge for us and our peers. We helped each other through this. What's important to understand is that the need for PPE at these levels was unbudgeted by many of us, and for not-for-profit organizations, this was a large, unexpected expense. Some of my peers do continue to struggle to obtain adequate supplies of PPE, but I do think that that is becoming more attainable for all of us. So we've budgeted neutral for our fiscal year. We have no margin. Our focus was on expense control, and with the additional cost of PPE and a 20% reduction in our visit volume, clearly revenue has taken a hit. Most organizations have a large volume of Medicare patients, and Medicare changed its payment model in January, which has a component of necessary in-person visits to determine payment. During the pandemic, telehealth, which is a great tool for providing care, Medicare does not recognize as a billable service. Governor Sununu's executive order has relieved some of the burden on Medicaid and commercial insurers to pay for for telehealth, but for those of us, Medicare is 70 to 85% of our census, and so that is a tremendous burden. We also care for clients in the Choices for Independence program, which is a long-term support program supported by Medicaid. These programs historically are challenged by low reimbursement, which limits organizations' ability to pay competitive wages and leads to workforce shortages and access to service. This brings me to workforce. Workforce has been impacted by school closures, leading to staffing challenges. Other staff are choosing not to work for fear of spreading the virus to their families as they care for elders, children, and aging spouses. Keeping the workforce safe and healthy is a priority. They are truly frontline, and in the home setting, there are unknown exposure risks. Our industry has diligently approached every funding opportunity that has arisen through the Paycheck Protection Program. It's allowed us to have a workforce at the ready. The Long-Term Care Stabilization Program will provide stipends for those eligible frontline workers, and stimulus payments will assist us all with cash flow. However, many agencies, especially smaller ones, were concerned about sustainability prior to COVID-19, and this has just made it even more challenging. And as a rural state, we need the support of all of our agencies to serve our population. I think it's fair to say that we've been humbled by the support of our communities and businesses with PPE, cleaning solutions, and monetary donations. However, the next chapter is an unknown for us. We rely on hospitals and medical practices for our referrals, and if they don't resume operations, then the effect will be even greater. We are a critical link in the healthcare system, and our staff and our plight is not receiving the same attention as the plight of the hospitals. We do serve the most vulnerable in the place that they all want to be, their home. So what are the opportunities that are arising for us in the near future? I think what would help us is a rate relief on the Medicaid side that would be helpful for organizations that have a large Medicaid population. Many times it's 50 cents on the dollar for our costs. Public funding to assist with vital services such as senior clinics, provision of care in our rural settings, and funds to implement robust telehealth programs can be used to decrease isolation and ensure that people are seeking the appropriate care. Lastly, I think it's how do we support our frontline workers, whether it be for safe child care or the reassurance that they will be supported if they indeed test positive for COVID or other challenges that they're experiencing. So thank you for listening. And are there any questions that I may answer for you?
Thank you, Beth. Much appreciated. Michelle, would you like to lead us off?
Sure. Now, I don't need a five-star, right? You can hear me?
Yes, I can.
Okay, great. So thank you very much, Beth, for giving us this overview of the home health care sector in our state and certainly the impacts of COVID. Just if you could briefly tell us, how many home health agencies are there across the state? I mean, do we have equal access across the state? And the second part of that is you had indicated that the relief funds could be certainly helpful in developing a robust telehealth program. And how that can be used in home health, because certainly some services you provide are hands-on.
Sure.
And obviously long-term reimbursement by Medicare would be necessary, I suppose, to keep that successful.
Sure. So I don't know exactly how many agencies are throughout the state. I know that there are approximately 40 that are represented in our association, and then there are others. I would tell you that the North Country does not have the support and the coverage for the agencies. Access is a tremendous issue. I would say Concord, even the Lakes region south, and the rest of the state is covered by multiple agencies. And so access in the North Country is the greatest challenge for our population. And we know that that is where many of our aging seniors are living. So your second question was about telehealth and hands-on.
Mm-hmm.
So we use telehealth. There are many different ways. So with the video monitoring, we can, see the patient and certainly triage the patient if there are issues. I think in the COVID-19 world, it really allows us to have contact with people so that we can ensure that we can manage symptoms, we can decrease their isolation and their depression. Also, many telehealth products in the true telehealth world have peripherals which allow you to monitor blood pressure. They allow you to monitor weight for those patients who have challenges with congestive heart failure. And so you're able to identify symptoms before they do lead them into a hospitalization, so reducing the risk of hospitalization. On the hospice side, it's similar. Many of our hospice patients really require a support network and symptom management, but many people also don't want us in the house. So being able to have a robust telehealth program, which is different than telemedicine, would be extremely valuable. As I did mention, Governor Sununu has recognized from a Medicaid and a commercial insurance perspective and has mandated that be covered. That was true prior to COVID-19, but under COVID-19, the rates are intended to be comparable. Medicare, however, which unfortunately we don't have control over at the state level, although our congressional delegation is very supportive in Washington, does not recognize telehealth for home health as a billable service, and therefore it is not included in our reimbursement. So that is a challenge.
It certainly sounds like it.
Yeah, and then your third question was?
I think you touched them all. It was
okay.
How to use telehealth and about the Medicare piece of it. So thank you, Beth.
Thank you, Michelle.
Okay.
There are questions from other members of the board?
Yes, we have a question from Kathleen Reardon.
Thank you, Kathleen.
Sorry, I was on mute. Thank you, Beth, for that presentation. I have, it may be a very detailed question, but you had mentioned that a lot of the home health care agencies, a high percentage of your funding comes from Medicare. And I know the weekly stipends for frontline workers, I think that that's Medicaid related. So my question is that something that your agencies are able to access, or is it only Medicaid specific?
So that is a great question. So when the stipend was announced a month ago, certainly, you know, a lot of the emphasis was on frontline and home health workers. So we have spent the last 4 weeks, me and most of my peers, dialoguing and trying to understand the stipend. Over the last, we are a Medicaid-eligible provider. We are a Medicaid provider. And so over the last week, guidance has just been released that our staff, because in doing their normal work, would potentially see Medicaid clients are eligible for the long-term care stipend, which will be helpful. So to understand, though, we just received confirmation on that last week, and so certainly our workforce is anxiously awaiting. Not all of our direct care workforce are eligible. We have to ensure that they are in the Medicaid on the Medicaid side. So private duty employees, if they just see private pay, would not be eligible. But yes, so the good news is that we have just been many of us have just been approved for the program, and that will help going forward.
Thank you.
Thank you. We have about 2 minutes left. Are there other questions from members of the board?
And again, that's 5-star to ask the question, 5-star. Donnelly, it doesn't appear that anyone has raised their hand.
Okay, great. Thank you so much, Beth. Thank you for your time and your thoughtful presentation. I think we all learned a little something. Appreciate it.
Well, great. If there's anything else I can do for you, please let me know. Have a good day.
Thank you. You as well. Our next presenter is Eric Johnson, the CEO for the Northern Human Services.
Thank you, and good afternoon. I'm actually in my office in Conway, and I'm alone. My name is Eric Johnson, and I am the CEO of Northern Human Services. I've been the CEO for the past 7 years. Before that, I served as the Chief of Operations for 16 years. I have worked for Northern for a total of 36 years, starting out as a case manager in 1984. I've been fortunate to have worked during the years of steady growth and expansion when the New Hampshire Community-Based System of Care for Adults and Children who Experienced the Challenges of Mental Illness was built. At the same time, I was also part of the development of the state system that provides supports and services to children and adults who have intellectual disabilities, physical disabilities, and brain injuries. Northern Human Services has also been a long-term provider of outpatient substance use disorder services. We are a very large private nonprofit that has collaborated with the Department of Health and Human Services for over 40 years. We operate under two important contracts with the state, which support our work in serving many of the most vulnerable citizens living across Northern New Hampshire. I want to note that my experience has been that the department is a supportive partner in community service delivery, and it holds its contractors accountable for quality service delivery as well as meeting contract requirements. In the end, however, it is up to each individual agency like mine to sustain its operations in a cost-effective manner and to keep pace with evolving standards of care and complex reimbursement requirements. Over the past three decades, the community mental health and developmental services systems that have evolved in New Hampshire have risen to face many challenges, and they have succeeded. Much of this success can be attributed to the support that each agency receives from the two professional associations that Northern belongs to. They are the New Hampshire Community Behavioral Health Association and the Community Support Network. Both associations are led by very experienced directors, and each benefits from having board members who assume leadership roles, which is key to moving statewide issues forward. Leading Northern Human Services has allowed me the unique opportunity to manage both the mental health and the developmental service systems in the most rural environment of New Hampshire. Our catchment area reaches from the Canadian border south to Wolfboro and west to Pyrmont. The primary office locations are in Berlin, Colebrook, Littleton, Conway, and Wolfboro. Northern provides services throughout Coos, Carroll, and Northern Grafton counties. We are operating more than 18 service sites across the region. We cover 155 miles from north to south and more than 40% of the geographic area of the state. Assuring widespread access to our services in a cost-effective manner has been a constant balancing act throughout the history of the agency. Sometimes when I'm at meetings in southern New Hampshire and I meet new people, many often comment that they have never heard of Northern Human Services. They often ask, "Are you up near the notch?" I feel like it is difficult to briefly explain really where we are and what we do for work up here. And frankly, I have a certain level of pride that historically we do not usually need or wish to draw attention to our work or the challenges that we face. This is a rare time when Northern feels a need to reach out and ask for consideration. Briefly, what this agency does best is to provide a comprehensive array of services. The services include outpatient mental health treatment for people of all ages, psychiatric evaluation and medication monitoring services, case management, supportive employment, community-based symptom management, assertive community treatment, and 24/7 staffed residential treatment services. We also provide 24/7 emergency psychiatric services with a prescriber on call at all times. We provide early childhood, family support, residential, and community-based day services for adults with developmental disabilities and brain injuries. We provide victims of crime treatment services, drug court services, infant mental health services, EAP services, and a multitude of other programs such as child impact and professional consultation within county jails, most hospitals, of which there are 7 in our catchment area, local nursing homes, and schools. Northern employs board-certified psychiatrists, nurse practitioners, psychologists, master's level staff, nurses, and bachelor's level staff. We also employ a large number of direct support staff who have been with us for many years. The staff that work in our 5 group homes are dedicated and are on the front line during this frightening time. We also contract with 130 home care providers who provide daily support and services to people with developmental disabilities. There is not another provider in Northern New Hampshire that offers this service capacity and level of specialized services. Northern currently serves more than 4,600 individuals and families each year. Many of the people receive long-term services that last for years as they experience conditions that are lifelong, and they require extensive support to maintain living in their local communities to avoid institutionalization in long-term care facilities. When at full staff, Northern employs 660 people. We currently have about 200 who are out of work due to the COVID pandemic. We have not laid off, nor have we terminated any employees. Many are seeking unemployment benefits. For some, we do not have work for them to carry out, as their primary responsibilities are to support clients face-to-face in their local communities. The stay-at-home order has resulted in a significant number of people not engaging in services. With reduced service provision inevitably comes reduced revenue. The vast majority of our services are reimbursed by Medicaid. The Department of Health and Human Services has been very supportive in providing short-term regulatory relief to support agencies like Northern in providing services in alternative manners such as telehealth and telephonic communications. Nonetheless, face-to-face services are at the core of our business, and as long as the stay-at-home order remains in effect, we will see reduced revenues. Returning staff to work will need to be a gradual process as the demand for services increases. Many employees who are currently not working will likely seek alternative employment if they are not called back to work in a timely manner. This will create challenges to hire and train new staff. We anticipate an increased demand for mental health services after the peak of the pandemic subsides due to delayed stress reactions and adjustment disorders. I read yesterday that scientists at the Center for Infectious Disease Research and Policy lay out three scenarios for how the COVID-19 pandemic will progress over the next few months. The bottom line is that experts suggest the outbreak will last between 18 and 24 months. As reserves diminish due to decreased revenues, the need to maintain the agency's capacity to pay bills that support our large infrastructure and the need to meet payroll will become challenging as long as the COVID crisis continues. Of major concern, Northern did not qualify for federal assistance through the Federal Payroll Protection Program because we employ more than 500 people and we did not meet the criteria for exceptions where the employee count could exceed 500. We would like to be considered for financial assistance from the $1.25 billion in relief funds that New Hampshire has recently been allocated. I should note that all of the other nine community mental health centers and nine area agencies did meet the criteria for the payroll protection program loans, and the majority have secured funding. My request would be based on the funding amount which we would have been eligible for were we to have qualified for the program. The request for funding would be used to support payroll costs, utilities, and facility rent fees. The prioritization and future viability of nonprofits who provide services to the state's most vulnerable citizens has not been in the forefront in the recent press. Community-based long-term care is not often thought of in the same context of health care when funding is the issue being debated. At some point, everyone needs medical care, but not everyone will need or seek brief treatment or long-term care services. This may lead some people to believe that these services are not critical or as much of a priority for consideration during this unprecedented time. In closing, the simple mission statement of Northern Human Services is to advocate for and serve those most in need. It is my job to prepare and not to wait until things deteriorate or become a crisis. History has shown that it is exponentially more costly and problematic to wait until after a large nonprofit business is in financial trouble before intervention occurs. Waiting too long will destabilize the operation and the standards of quality that exist to maximize client safety. Once disrupted, these standards can take years to once again reach acceptable levels. Thank you for the opportunity to present today. I'm happy to answer any questions.
Thank you very much. Michelle, would you like to lead us off?
Sure, great. And Eric, thank you very much for your presentation. It's quite clear in listening to you that your organization is extremely comprehensive, and the breadth and scope of services that you provide make your organization unique when you look at the community mental health centers or the other DD-type centers. You've got them all wrapped under one roof. You had made some mention about many of your services reimbursed by Medicaid, but you also mentioned about two contracts with the Department of Health and Human Services. So from a high-level perspective, can you kind of explain where your sources of revenue are? Certainly you have some fee-for-service, but are there contracts as well? And could you sort of give me by percentage what the different sources are?
Yes, I can. Medicaid is probably about 80% of our revenue stream. The sources of that are on the mental health side through the three managed care entities that are operating in the state. The contract with the state for mental health services provides us with some limited state dollars to fulfill contract scope of service requirements. However, the majority of the revenue that we produce is paid by the MCOs directly in terms of Medicaid. We also do bill and receive Medicare funds, commercial insurance. We have several different grants. The Attorney General's Office provides us with funding to treat victims of crime. We get Tillotson grant money to do early childhood services. The grants are relatively, and I'm not trying to diminish their value, but relatively small in comparison to the Medicaid dollars that we generate, because on the developmental services side, that is our primary source of revenue, and it is all through service delivery and home-based community care waiver. And the contract that we hold with the state on developmental services is inclusive of a pretty wide array of services from birth till death. And our developmental services budget is larger than our mental health budget. We also do self-pay for people that don't have insurance. We have sliding fee scale for people with inability to pay. We really don't do a lot of fundraising. We don't have a development or marketing position that's full-time that works on that for us. So I don't know if that helps to clarify a little bit about our revenue.
Yeah, so it sounds like a majority of it is vulnerable to volume.
Correct.
Okay, great. Thank you.
Thank you, Michelle. We have a minute or two left. Are there further questions from members of the board?
Donnelly, we have a hand raised from Jeff Myers. Go ahead, Jeff.
Thank you. Eric, thank you so much for your presentation. And I also want to thank you for your leadership in the North Country over many years for providing really critical services, as do your counterparts all over the state. I want to make sure I understand. I thought I heard you say that of all, and it's reflected in your submission to the advisory committee, that of all of the community mental health centers and their agencies, yours was the only one that was not approved for a Paycheck Protection Act loan. Is that correct?
We did not meet the criteria. We weren't denied because we actually didn't apply. But there were exceptions to the 500 employee count, but with those you had to have certain limitations on annual revenue, and we were in excess of that criteria.
I see. Yeah. Okay. Two other points quickly. Has your organization, or do you know if the other community mental health agencies have applied for the FCC telehealth grants?
I do not know the answer to that, Jeff.
Okay. All right. Well, I can follow up with you offline. And then could you just talk for, I think you mentioned a little bit, could you add a little bit more information in terms of if you were to receive a money out of the $1.25 billion on the recommendation of this advisory committee, how you would purpose those funds?
Yes.
How would they be prioritized, in other words?
Yep. To keep things simple, what I would do is I would have the request based on the exact same methodology as the federal program, and what was allowable in that was covering payroll costs, rent, and utilities. And the formula that they used was 2.5 times your monthly cost for each of those items. So I would simply ask for that since I didn't qualify. And if the as the two associations work with the gopher committees on other requests, I would not duplicate at all what I would be requesting today. Those two association requests would be separate from this altogether.
Yeah. And would that money allow you to rehire the 200 staff that you've had to lay off at this point, or something close to that?
If we could get people back into service, yes, that would help us to make that happen quicker. We would definitely attribute the dollars to the purposes for which they were asked. And if we didn't end up needing to use them all, which I'd be surprised, we would be willing to return the dollars.
Okay. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. So we're out of our 15-minute time zone, but if there's a burning question that needs to be asked, we're happy to take it. Joe, is there any other questions remaining?
Honestly, there does not appear to be so.
Okay, great. Thank you so much for your presentation, Eric. It's much appreciated.
Thank you.
Next on our list for presenters is Tom Blonsky, the President and CEO of New Hampshire Catholic Charities, who's joined by Brendan Williams, the President and CEO of New Hampshire Healthcare Association. Thank you for joining us. Tom, the floor is yours.
Tom, could you hit 5-star for us, please? 5-star.
No pressure, Tom.
Can everyone hear me now?
We can. Thank you, Tom.
Great. Sorry about that. I pressed 5-star, and then I had to press pound after, so... good afternoon. I just want to thank all of you for taking the time to hear us out. I know this is a difficult decision, a lot of dollars at stake and a lot of need at stake. So I can understand also the importance this is for all of you and the pressure it is for all of you. So I just want to say thank you for taking the time for all of us. So Catholic Charities, this year we're celebrating our 75th anniversary. As Donna Lee had mentioned, my name is Tom Blonsky. I've been the president and CEO of Catholic Charities New Hampshire a little over 14 years now. We are a large human service organization that serves the state of New Hampshire with a budget of a little over $83 million. Fully staffed, we would be about 120 employees. 66% of our revenues are related to healthcare, specifically long-term care. And about 82% of our employees are related to healthcare out of our total employees. As an aside, I won't focus on social services, but I do want to thank you for your support of the New Hampshire Food Bank, which is probably one of our best-known programs. I know there potentially has been a recommendation of some monies earmarked for them. But getting back to healthcare, historically, the nursing home industry in New Hampshire has been, from a Medicaid perspective, in New England, we are the lowest funded in regards to the Medicaid out of all the states in New England. And historically, across the states, we are at the bottom of the heap, around 45 out of 50 states in terms of the Medicaid shortfall per Medicaid resident per day. It's close to $50 per Medicaid resident per day. And I'm just mentioning that to give you perspective in regards to how thin our margins are in regards to how we operate. We certainly appreciate the slight bump in the Medicaid rate last year that was presented to us, and that has helped, but there still remains a tremendous shortfall in terms of day-to-day operations. So in light of how difficult it was before the pandemic hit, you know, operating on a typical margin of 1% to 3% on an extremely good year, but realistically it was closer to break even, if that, on any given year. We have been looking at, in these first 4 months, projecting out a couple of months forward, we at Catholic Charities will be projecting about $1 million loss, and within a year, all things being equal, we will look at approximately $5.5 million spread across our 6 facilities across the state and 1 facility that we provide pro bono management services to. We operate 6 nursing homes, 3 in Manchester, 1 in Windham, 1 in Laconia, 1 in Berlin, and 1 in St. Anne's, 3 assisted living and 1 independent living facility. We did sell 1 facility last May in Jaffrey, because of money losses there and revenue losses. So part of what we've been looking at is an additional increase in PPE expense. Currently, I think the number I sent in when I answered the questions was about $500,000. We're up to about $500,000. We're up to about $600,000 right now. Those are unbudgeted costs in light of how we've had to respond to the pandemic. Every new admission we receive right now is on immediate isolation for 14 days with full PPE precautions. Any resident who tests positive in our facility also would be put on full PPE precautions in a COVID bed or on a COVID unit that we've had to set aside. That is a bed that we are not receiving revenue on unless we put a COVID positive patient in one of those beds. So in addition to the increased costs with PPE supplies, we also have the lowered census. Our census is down by about 11% off of budget in the last 6 to 7 weeks. That is directly attributable to hospitals whose censuses have been down, as all of us know, because they have only been open until this past week to COVID residents. For example, Mount Carmel, our largest facility in the state at 120 beds, is at 100 beds today. So they are 20 beds down in census. In regards to payer mix, I know that has come up in some of the questions. About 65% to 80%+ of our payer mix is Medicaid, and I'm giving you a range because it depends on the area of the state in regards to what our payer mix is. So for Berlin, for example, our Medicaid percentage mix up there is 82%. Title 18 or Medicare dollars, they range anywhere from 15% to 20%. And I just explained to you earlier at the start of my conversation the short Medicaid shortfall we have for every Medicaid resident that we admit to our facility. And how we make up for that shortfall financially is with Medicare residents and private pay dollars. And with Medicare admissions, usually they are referred from hospitals to come to our facility for rehab or other skilled services. They are short-term residents who are then transitioned back home, usually after a couple of months, after 100 days or so. Those Medicare admissions, as you can imagine, have plummeted in the last 6 to 7 weeks. What used to be 18% to 20% of our payer mix is now, closer to 5% to 10% of our payer mix. And private pay residents who make up the last component, actually we have third-party insurance, which is 1% to 2%, but private pay mix is in the range of 10% to 15% of our payer mix. And that makes up the complement of how we are funded for our nursing facilities. We did not qualify for PPE support because of our volume of staff and the revenue, our annual revenue, which were too high. So I am, like everyone else that preceded me, very concerned about our future stabilization. We, like Northern Community Services and the home care services, really serve the most vulnerable population in our state. You know, our average age of residents is in different facilities anywhere from 87 to 90 years old. And if they're in the nursing facility, they're there for a reason, generally because they cannot care for themselves at home because of multiple comorbidities, or the families or caretakers don't have the resources to be able to meet their needs, their care needs, in a one-to-one setting. So they end up in our nursing facilities. So concerned about what the future holds for us in regards to being able to continue to afford this new normal of additional PPE equipment as guided by CMS, as required by CMS, and how we are, what we're going to look like in the future in regards to how we're going to be able to afford to continue to incent our staff to pay at the current rates that we offer them outside of the long-term care stabilization funding, or whether or not we have to continue to compete with unemployment funds, which are much more attractive for people, our staff, to stay home rather than to continue to work. So my understanding is that the LTC stabilization dollars will run out by the end of June. What will happen after that in regards to incenting my staff to continue to show up to work every day at the risk of exposing themselves to COVID and their families back home without being able to match that kind of funding that they're receiving right now, which is about an additional $7.50 an hour. We would never be able to afford that from our own budget right now, looking at, like I had mentioned earlier, a loss of $1 million over the next 4 months and $5.5 million over the next year without additional funding. So I have a concern about how we're going to be able to address this moving forward and continue to support our staff so that they're paid fairly and they're paid just wages and have some kind of, like I said, incentive to be able to show up to work in light of the exposure that they are facing on a day-to-day basis. I am open for questions if anyone has any.
Thank you, Tom. Do you want to take questions from Michelle, or because you're presenting with Brendan, would you rather have Brendan have an opportunity and then questions for both of you?
Probably the latter, if that's okay.
Yes.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
This is Brendan Williams. Can you hear me?
Yes. Thank you, Brendan.
I don't really have anything to say to improve upon what Tom said. I think he described the situation that facilities of all types are experiencing. I just, you know, would reemphasize the point about personal protective equipment. The costs are just extraordinary, and it really is a wild west out there in terms of one's ability to access things like disposable isolation gowns. I delivered 250 today to a facility in Portsmouth. Normally, 250 gowns would have cost 25 cents each, so it would have been about $100. Today, that box of gowns would be worth about $2,400 because the price of the gowns is in excess of $6 per gown out on the market, assuming one can even get those gowns passed either the Chinese government or the U.S. government, which have a tendency to impound a lot of what we order. So it, I think Skilled Nursing News had estimated that the additional costs of personal protective equipment for a 100-bed facility would be in excess of $10,000 a month. And I'm not sure if that estimate occurred before the federal requirement that every nursing home employee wear a mask while at work, but that certainly has also added to the cost. So that's been very concerning, and as Tom said, the staffing issue has been very concerning as well. We appreciate the long-term care stabilization program. Like anything that's brand new, it's had its hiccups. I think only a handful, if that, of providers have received any stipends so far through that program. But because the program was announced a few weeks ago, providers have been paying those stipends out in order to hold on to their staff. So certainly this is an existential crisis when it comes to funding.
Thank you very much.
Can I make one more comment, Donnelly, please?
Yes, you can.
Thank you. So just for perspective, and I realize Massachusetts is population-wise is quite a bit larger than us, but they are spending another $130 million on nursing home care alone on top of the $130 million that they previously made available on April 15th. Even looking at Alabama, for example, they for nursing home funding alone, they had committed $20 per resident per day, per Medicaid resident per day. If we were to look at that for New Hampshire, that would be closer to a $30 million number than the $20 million number that is being considered. And at the $20 million level, we're about $13.36 per day per Medicaid resident. And I do want to thank all of you and applaud you for understanding and considering how important the lives of seniors are in light of so much negative press out there regarding nursing homes, and even people commenting about the value of a senior's life versus getting the economy back on track. I don't think they should be mutually exclusive. It should be a both and proposition, not that one should be traded off for the other. So I do want to thank you for stepping up to the plate and considering this amount to support our nursing facilities and, most importantly, our residents.
Amen.
Well, on behalf of the board, I'm happy to say you're welcome. Michelle, we have about 2 minutes left. If you want to lead off with a question, and then we can determine whether there are others.
Okay, sure. And I'll apologize in advance. I have two questions. My first one is in regards to your response on question six, and you had indicated that if you were able to get these funds, you would use them to provide substantial pay increase for your frontline workers to incentivize them to continue staying at work. And I certainly understand that the Long-Term Care Stabilization Fund is helping with you now. The $1.25 billion we have is really one time and has to be expensed out before the end of the calendar year. So my question, in light of what you just talked about, Medicaid reimbursement, that being a large part of your payer mix, how would you sustain that beyond these funds?
Well, I think the next 6 months are going to be extremely trying as we continue to look at rebuilding our census. So in light of the fact of the projected loss of revenue due to lowered census, we have a very large, significant PR campaign to work on as an industry to get people to trust nursing homes again. There is a sense that now, I would imagine, with all of the press that we've been getting nationally, that you go to a nursing home, you're going to die or you're going to catch some kind of awful virus. To build that rapport again and to have those positive outcomes like we've experienced in the past, that is going to be critical, and it's going to take a while to get our census back up and our revenue back up, which I hope will be by the start of the new year. So to get us through the end of the end of this calendar year would be critical.
Okay, thank you. And you kind of touched on my second question. You know, I do recognize that, you know, the prevalence of COVID has been seen in places where there are a number of individuals congregating together. So long-term care, prisons, it's just unfortunately the situation we face. How do you think long-term care will change after this, or will it change from what we've learned with COVID?
I can address that a little bit, Tom, and I'm sure you have ideas too. I think one of the things that I've seen nationally is that there hasn't been much of an emphasis placed when it comes to the Medicaid share of cost for facility infrastructure. Obviously, the thing that's most sympathetic when it comes to funding is the wages of caregivers and staff, and the capital needs tend to sort of fall by the wayside. But I think in the future, considering the strain that we've seen this place upon facilities in terms of taking beds offline in order to be able to isolate those who are presumptive positive or positive for COVID-19, that we're going to have to, as a society, but also as a state, just look at the infrastructure, the physical plants of facilities, because I think that that has been a challenge. It's been something that's been neglected.
I would agree with that. I think in the future you're probably going to see facilities that have more private rooms, that you're not going to see the old three-room facilities and fewer semi-private rooms, just so that we have – I think the new norm is going to be a tendency towards social distancing and not these big, large events. And infection control protocol is something that we – typically follow anyway. It is a requirement in the nursing facilities. We're very regulated, but it's going to be, I think, much more predominant in regards to encouraging folks who to exercise those same that same protocol when they leave the facility, because a lot of this, as you know, is being brought into the facility, not the other way around. So ensuring that people follow infection control protocols outside of the facility as well to keep viruses at bay in as much as we're able to.
Great. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Are there further questions from board members? We're a little bit over time, but.
Dolly, this is Joe. We have a hand raised from Jeff Myers.
Tom and Brendan, thank you for your presentation. I'll be very quick because I know we're running tight on time. I agree with you. I think there's an existential crisis that your nursing homes are facing in the state of New Hampshire right now and across the country that absolutely should be addressed, including in New Hampshire with some of these funds. I just want to clarify, I'm looking at your submission and questions 4 and 5. I'm just trying to get a hard figure on what's your estimate of your members per month loss right now in New Hampshire, taking into account the cost of PPE and decreased census and, you know, other costs that you have. What's the per month loss that you're estimating?
So based on the annual projection, all things being equal, of a $5.5 million loss, we would be just under $500,000 loss per month, $450,000.
So you're not including the additional pay that you might have to provide workers?
No, I'm not including that.
Okay. Okay, that's helpful. Thank you very much.
Okay.
Thank you. Are there further questions?
Don Lee, we don't have any further hands raised.
Okay. Thank you very much, Tom and Brendan. We appreciate your presentation very much.
We appreciate your good work.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. You're welcome. Next presenter today is Steve Ahnen, President of the New Hampshire Hospital Association, Tom Mee, the CEO of the North Country Health, and my understanding is that Steve Norton from Solution Health is also joining.
That is correct.
Okay, great. So the floor is yours, Steve.
All right, thank you so much. I appreciate the opportunity to present, and I want to thank my colleagues who have gone before us. Obviously, the COVID-19 challenge is one that is affecting all of us and the healthcare system, and so the perspectives of all of those is very important. As you noted, in addition to myself, the president of the Hospital Association, we represent all hospitals here in the state. Tom Mee from North Country Healthcare, a multi-hospital system in the North Country, will be presenting along with Steve Norton, a multi-hospital system in the southern part of the state. So I'm going to be brief, and then I'll toss it over to my colleagues to share their perspective. But as you know, hospitals in the state have, you know, gone to unprecedented steps to prepare for and to manage the care of patients with COVID-19, beginning back in mid-March, when hospitals, at the urging of national as well as state officials, suspended non-urgent elective procedures to preserve resources, PPE, hospital inpatient capacity, as well as to prevent the spread of the virus. That began back in mid-March and certainly was an important step in trying to help prevent the spread of the disease, but has had a significant financial impact on hospitals. About a 40% to 50% reduction in revenue on a monthly basis translates to a little over $200 million in lost revenue, which is just simply staggering and unsustainable. Whether you're a large hospital, whether you're a small hospital, it's simply going to cripple you in terms of your ability to continue to serve your patients and communities without significant financial support and investment in hospitals. As you know, hospitals have been receiving federal support, and we appreciate that. The delegation in Washington has been very, very helpful and supportive, and I will provide an update to the document that I sent to you earlier. In addition to the funds that we had identified at that time, last week an additional $112 million came in to rural hospitals in the northern and western portions of the state for rural hospitals from the Emergency Relief Fund out of the CARES Act. That was very helpful, but certainly didn't go to all hospitals, and hospitals in the southern part of the state and the seacoast did not receive any of those funds, and all hospitals continue to be challenged with all of this. This is not an event that will end at the end of May, certainly didn't end at the end of April, and will continue for the next several months. Would anticipate that, you know, by the end of June, we will see somewhere in the neighborhood of $700 million in losses across all hospitals. As you know, last week we began the resumption of time-sensitive elective procedures, which is an important step as we move back towards reopening the economy and all of the rest. But it will be done very slowly. And in fact, I know some hospitals that have begun that process actually had to postpone some of those procedures because of, you know, the number of COVID patients they had or the number of ICU beds that they had simply needed to take that slow. And we'll see that over the coming months. And I would anticipate that as hospitals start that process, we will need to continue to keep an eye on all of those factors and to ensure that if there are increases in the number of COVID patients or ongoing challenges with the supply chain for personal protective equipment and testing and the like, we will need to make adjustments as we go forward. I think there are a number of things that we can look to that can be very helpful as we go forward, and we can talk a little bit more about those as we get into the question and answer period. The Hospital Association has been very engaged working with its members, working with stakeholders at the state and federal levels to try and ensure that we break down barriers, eliminate regulatory roadblocks to being able to provide the right care at the right place at the right time. Many of those have been very helpful, and we're hopeful that those can continue as we move forward. So again, I'm going to stop, and I'm going to turn it over to my colleagues. I'll toss it to Tom Mee first, and then we'll go to Steve so we can get to your questions as well. Thank you very much. Tom, are you able to jump in?
Tom and Steve, could you please press 5-star for us so we can unmute your line? I believe Tom and Steve go ahead.
I think that did it. This is Tommy. Everybody can hear me?
We can hear you.
Yes, we can.
Great. Thank you very much, and I welcome the platform, and thanks to Steve and everyone that spoke before me. My name is Tom Mee. I'm the Chief Executive Officer of North Country Healthcare. We cover all of Colops County. We represent three hospitals and a home care and hospice, roughly 1,000 FTEs amongst the system, net patient service revenue of just about $120 million on an annual basis. In the North Country, we have seen lost revenues exceeding that we're seeing in our southern counterparts, with revenues down 50 to 60% since we began to reschedule elective procedures. And that's notable in a hospital industry where on any given month, typically a variance of only a point or two can be the difference between finishing in the black or the red, finishing a month 50 to 60% behind in net patient service revenue indicates staggering losses for us. We operate in Colops County, which I'm sure you're all aware is the largest, poorest, and the least populated county in the state of New Hampshire. We have a population density of 18 people per square mile. So residents of Colops County have been practicing social distancing for pretty much their lifetimes. And as a result, we have not seen a surge of COVID in the North Country. In fact, since testing began, we have seen only two positive COVID cases in Colops County, and that is not for a lack of testing. The end result is that beginning on March 16th, when we began to reschedule elective procedures, our hospitals have been largely empty. They look like ghost towns. The parking lots are empty. We, in fact, had a day where we had no ED volume, which in 32 years of healthcare administration is something that I have never had to say before, that we actually had no volume in our ED. And Colops County is also a vacation destination for people traveling from the south through the summer and into the fall for the colors. And we obviously do not anticipate much of a migration this year for vacations. In each of our markets, and we include Weeks Medical Center in Lancaster, Upper Connecticut Valley Hospital in Colebrook, and Roscoggin Valley Hospital in Berlin, and North Country Home Care and Hospice in Littleton, we are the largest employers in our region. It's notable that going into this, on a nationwide basis, 51% of rural hospitals were losing money before the COVID crisis. So this becomes even more problematic. Pre-COVID, two of the four North Country Healthcare affiliates were losing money. Of note, of that 1,000 FTE, we have not laid off or put anyone on involuntary furlough. As stated very eloquently previously by Eric, in the North Country, if we lay off or displace an employee, chances are we are not going to retain them. And someday, not soon, but someday volumes will return to normal levels, and I can't go into that with 80% of my workforce. So we have managed to trim our workforce about 8% by virtue of voluntary furloughs and people taking time off without pay. But to date, we have not laid anybody off. We saw a modest loss in March, approaching $1 million. The April books are not yet complete, but we will see a staggering loss in April of several millions of dollars. And while we have received both state and federal stimulus monies, I want to be very clear and very candid that to the extent that any of these accelerated payments are structured as loans, we are simply kicking the can down the road in terms of how long it takes for a New Hampshire hospital to become insolvent. We had adequate liquidity going into the crisis. The accelerated payments have helped our liquidity, but they will not be enough if they are loans to withstand this on a long-term basis. The only financial model that ensures ongoing viability of New Hampshire hospitals going forward are grants with the intention of keeping hospitals whole in terms of lost revenues. My closing point, there have been some silver linings associated with COVID, and one of those has been the leveraging of telehealth. And many of my colleagues have spent some time talking about this prior to me, but in the North Country, we have been able to leverage telehealth to provide access to patients in a manner that we wouldn't previously do prior to COVID. In fact, and this is our experience only, in some select service lines, most notably behavioral health, we are seeing increased compliance with treatment regimens and medication regimens and making appointments via telehealth. But post-COVID, we will have the perverse financial incentive where we either are not getting paid for telehealth or getting paid at a rate roughly one-third of what we would get for a pre-COVID visit. So, you know, on the I happen to be a registered nurse, so on the clinical and ethical side, being a hospital administrator, I've got a mechanism that is seemingly superior in terms of reaching a difficult-to-access population, but the fiduciary obligations I have as a system CEO prevent me from considering that because we simply can't afford that level of reimbursement for a necessary service. That concludes my presentation. I'm certainly willing to take any questions or comments at this time.
I think we might hold the questions until we make sure that everybody that presented would like to, if you don't mind. Steve, were you going to present or just be available for questions? As
I'll
in
give
Steve
you
Gordon.
Yes, okay. I'm here. Can you hear me now, Donna Huntley?
Yes, I can.
Can you hear me now? Okay, great. So I'll be brief. Solution to Health is a result of a combination of two systems, the Elliott in Manchester and Southern New Hampshire Health in Nashua. Came together given the common charitable mission, which includes acting as the largest provider of acute inpatient psychiatric care, as well as our community hospital activities. We operate across Hillsborough County. We have 290 beds at the Elliott, 170 beds at Southern New Hampshire Health, and the Manchester BNA, which provides home health care to residents across Hillsborough County. We have about 7,000 FTEs. And like my colleague said before, we changed our posture significantly, the implications of which have been significant from a financial perspective. In March, we had a negative 30% margin, which across the system was about a $16 million loss. And we haven't closed our books yet for April, but it's looking like we're going to see as much as a $26 million loss in April as well. We've seen some resurgence of care and activity because patients have been delaying care and the acuity is increasing and they're coming in. But we're nowhere near recovery. We're looking at right now at about 62-63% of the activity that we had before. So that means just in March, the first last 2 weeks of March and the month of April, we've lost almost $42 million. Now, as Steve said, we've been very grateful for the congressional support. We've seen about a third of that loss covered. As I said, we're grateful. But we don't anticipate seeing a decline in our losses through the end of our fiscal year, which is through June, and we're anticipating a loss of $75 million, which, you know, is obviously not sustainable, has severe implications for our activities as a community hospital and our ability to manage capital investments and the like. So New Hampshire is in an interesting place because we have three different types of hospitals right now. We have the North Country hospitals, which have not been touched necessarily by high rates of COVID, but are being hurt significantly by the lack of volumes. We have facilities like Concord and Dartmouth, which also are fairly lightly touched by the COVID hospitalizations. And then you have facilities like the Elliott, CMC, St. Joe's, and Southern New Hampshire Health in Nashua, which are the hotspots in New Hampshire. They're not Massachusetts, they're not New York. And while that's good that we're not New York, what that also means is that we're going to be hampered in a different way from seeing a recurrence of business, because we're planning to live with COVID and a changed business cycle probably through the end of the year. So I'll stop there and take questions with my colleagues.
Thank you very much. Michelle, you want to lead us off?
Certainly, great. Thank you to all three of you for presenting. I, being in the healthcare industry, I'm sensitive and fully aware of the losses that we're all incurring and how staggering those numbers may become, dependent on how and when volumes might get back to normal. Also, being a member of this advisory board, hearing the economic impacts on all the other sectors, and it's quite clear the $1.25 billion that we have available is certainly not going to be enough to make everybody whole in healthcare and the other sectors. I think, you know, the intent is to provide some immediate relief as best as we can to the various sectors that have been financially hurt, and I understand some hospitals, and the longer this goes, more hospitals will really be on the edge. But I just want to ask the question, if these funds were available, you know, certainly it can give us some short-term mitigation, but how do you also position hospitals for mitigation of future financial challenges? I think, you know, we've all been able to learn lessons as we face these challenges, and just like to hear about what types of things you're thinking that perhaps these short-term funds could help you in investing in the future.
I'll start real quick, Michelle. This is Steve Onan. I think, you know, obviously some of the most significant challenges, as you've heard from Tom and Steve, in terms of the impact that this is having on their institutions and their ability to continue to serve their patients and communities, those funds are going to be incredibly helpful to shore things up, to help them continue to be able to do that, to get them to the other side so that they can continue to serve their patients and communities. I think there are a couple of things that I would suggest that, you know, we ought to start thinking about. You know, there have been a number of efforts to streamline, to eliminate, you know, barriers and roadblocks to providing care in new and innovative ways. And certainly the use of telehealth and the expanded use of telehealth, I think, has been incredibly important. You know, Medicare is one of the largest payers of healthcare services in the country, and they've been one of the slowest to move towards reimbursing telehealth services more broadly. And I think they've certainly made some moves in that direction. CMS Administrator Seema Verma made the comment that, you know, telemedicine is here to stay and we're not going to go back. But we need to make certain that all of the gains that we've been able to make, both at the federal level but as well as at the state level, are allowed to continue, that we simply don't revert back to the way it used to be at some point in the future. The other thing I think I would suggest is, as we think about, you know, all of the planning that we do with in partnership with state and federal, you know, partners, is, you know, thinking about the next pandemic, hopefully not the next pandemic, but certainly the next certain public health emergency or challenge, you know, what do we need to be thinking about doing as it relates to the public health infrastructure, all of the folks that we that really need to be a part of, you know, contact tracing and doing all of those kinds of things, but also, you know, the stockpile. You know, when every state in the country is relying on the strategic national stockpile as the backstop for their emergency preparedness plans, that's a challenge when every state in the country is trying to tap that strategic national stockpile. So I think those are some of the conversations that we're going to need to have once we get through all of this, once we make certain that we have the resources that are necessary to help hospitals get through to the other side. There's no question healthcare is going to look very differently, but if, you know, if we don't do enough now to ensure that those hospitals can continue to survive and serve their communities, we'll certainly be challenged in the future.
Great, thank you.
So that has us about a few minutes over, but if there's another question, we're willing to take that. Joe?
We have a question from Bill Artiser. Go ahead, Bill.
Thank you, Joe, and thank you, gentlemen, for a very good presentation. I guess, Steve, you mentioned that, you know, a number of lost revenues during this period, for example, is $200 million for a month across the state. I'm assuming that there has been as well an impact on the expense side of the income statement. Could you address whether there's been any expense mitigation that might offset that $200 million gross revenue reduction? Thank you.
Certainly. Thank you, Bill, for the question. And Steve Norton, if you want to jump in, go right ahead.
Yeah, so we've taken a number of initiatives, Bill, to mitigate expenses. We've reduced, we've furloughed, changed reduction in hours to about 60,000 hour reduction, you know, beginning March 16th and extending through April. The numbers that I provided you for April for the system include those expense mitigation efforts. We're obviously not doing any discretionary spending. We've eliminated all capital spend at this point, except for things that were on the fly, like our development of a cancer center. And we are getting prepared now to trigger a whole nother set of cost-saving initiatives, which become, frankly, more and more draconian the deeper we get into these monthly losses. I can provide, you know, our expense mitigation plan to the committee if you thought that might be helpful.
I thank you very much for that. I think maybe the association could follow up with some more general sense. It doesn't have to be by particular system, but I think a general sense of what the expense mitigation impact has been against, you know, the revenue loss impact. And I thank you for clarifying that your numbers were net. Thank you.
And Bill, this is Steve Ahn, I would also want to say that those numbers that I provided are net of those expense mitigation efforts. You know, one of the challenges, as others have said prior to ours, is, you know, the ongoing costs of sort of standing up all of the things that are necessary to be able to respond to the COVID-19, you know, crisis. So accessing PPE, modifying one's facilities to stand up additional capacity inside your facility as well as outside your facility. So a number of things are ongoing that actually add to the costs and don't reduce those costs. But again, I would want to just note that those were inclusive of the mitigation efforts.
And this is Tom Mee from North Country. Our numbers were net as well. And in the hospital industry, there needs to be a recognition that a huge portion of our costs are fixed and are not variable according with patient volumes. And there simply exists no budget recovery plan that I can implement based on variable costs that would allow me to respond to a 50% reduction in monthly revenue.
Thank you.
Thank you so much. Are there further questions, Joe?
Donnelly, we have a hand raised from Jeff Myers. Go ahead, Jeff.
Thanks. Question for Steve Ahn. And Steve, first of all, both Steves, Tom as well. Thank you for your presentation. Steve, could you put in context the impact of the CARES distributions? Because for the benefit of the committee, I think everybody knows there's been a significant amount of money coming in to hospitals in the state, both in the general distribution under the CARES Act and then more recently, as you noted, in the rural distribution. But as a percentage of the loss, could you describe across the system, not just in one hospital or another, but as a system, what percentage of the loss are those CARES Act funds actually covering?
Well, when you look at it at a point in time, so if we look at towards the
right.
the end of April, we're well over $300 million in losses, and as of the end of April, we'd received about $110 million or so funds from the Emergency Relief Fund from the CARES Act. So, that offset, not quite less than a third.
Right.
The additional rural funds that came in just this last week in the month of May will help offset losses for some hospitals in the month of May. Again, obviously we don't have May. May's not closed, so we don't know the impact of everything in May, but based upon what I'm hearing from folks, I would anticipate that we'll be, around that $200 million in lost revenue again. So what I would also say is we need to remember that this is, something that is going to continue for some time to come. And I would
right.
say through the end of this year and
right.
Many are suggesting that, we won't get back to, pre-COVID types of volumes until well into 2021, and that's in a good case scenario where we don't have a spike in cases at some point down the road as we begin to open the economy back up a little bit more.
Yeah, right. What you're saying though is that really at best it may be covering 30% of the loss.
At best.
Yeah. Right. Okay. Thank you.
Any further questions? Okay, it sounds like no. All right. With that, thank you, gentlemen. Very much appreciate your presentation today.
Thank you very much.
Next
for your
on
time.
Our, you're welcome. Next on our presenting list is Bonnie Payette, the Executive Director of the New Hampshire Health Education Facilities Authority. Bonnie, the floor is yours.
Good afternoon. Are you able to hear me?
Yes, we are.
That's great. I am Bonnie Payette, Executive Director of New Hampshire Health and Education Facilities Authority, and I am joined by Susan Cummings, the Director of Operations and Finance for the Authority, who will be available to answer any questions. First, I would like to thank you for allowing us to present to you today. When we learned that the state was looking for possible organizations to disperse the funds, we started reaching out because we saw this as a way to not only support our not-for-profits, but to support the state as well, because this is what we were set up to do. The authority was set up by the state under RSA 195D and 195E to fund and support nonprofits in New Hampshire. Our mission was to work with the not-for-profit healthcare and educational entities to provide access to high-quality, readily available, low-cost financing alternatives. We accomplished this by issuing tax-exempt bonds and notes and by offering taxable low-interest rate loans. In response, through the years, we initially were only able to provide tax-exempt financing, so we worked with a lot of the hospitals, colleges, retirement communities, and other larger not-for-profits, but the executive director and the board saw a need to provide funding for smaller not-for-profits, so we developed a capital loan program and direct loan programs. The direct loan program is administered by the authority, which allows us to quickly respond to the impact that COVID-19 was having on our smaller not-for-profits. So on March 19th, the authority board voted to offer a deferment of loan payments for 3 months. Within a week, we received executed note amendments for 66% of our loan portfolio. This reduced the authority's revenues by $330,000 for the 3 months.
This decrease in revenue will impact our ability to provide future financing opportunities for our smaller institution. But these deferments allowed not-for-profits to hold on to their cash to support new immediate needs. My board will assess the impact of restarting the economy and will reassess whether or not the deferment needs to be extended. We have executed forbearance agreements for nonprofits with bonds to defer payments for 4 to 6 months, and we have approved the payroll protection program applications for entities that needed our approval. Our responses to the needs of our not-for-profits over the years shows the authority's dedication and awareness of the needs of nonprofits large and small. By the numbers, the authority has issued $11.9 billion in tax-exempt financing. Through our loan programs, we have provided $41.7 million to not-for-profits. Repayment on our loan program is 100%. Our board members represent different sectors of not-for-profits, legal counsel who works with not-for-profits, and a prior banker who financed for not-for-profits. We have well-established relationships with health and educational institutions in the state. We currently provide financing for over 50% of the members of the hospital association. We monitor financials and covenant compliance on a regular basis. We review requisitions to disperse funds for eligible expenses. We disperse funds for financings ranging from $10,000 to $125 million. As I mentioned earlier, we have developed and administered loan programs and implemented processes that allow us to review, approve, and disperse funds quickly and efficiently. We have heard from many sectors of our nonprofits, from the hospitals who are losing millions of dollars in revenue each week to child care centers who have had to close their doors or remain open with decreased ratios to provide care for essential workers in New Hampshire. The educational institutions face uncertainty for the fall. If they open in the traditional sense, will students come? How will families have been impacted, and what will the financial needs be for the coming year? Like most nonprofits, our hospitals, colleges, schools, healthcare centers, and many other agencies that we work with already provide discounts and do a significant amount to give back to those who do not have the ability to pay. The needs will be greater in the coming months and year. As I mentioned earlier, this is what we do. We were set up by the state to exclusively serve not-for-profit health and education entities. We would welcome the opportunity to continue to support them through these unprecedented times. We have partnered with them and seen incredible growth, but we have also been there when they have weathered hard times, all while they continue to provide the best care to meet the needs of the populations that they serve. We see two phases to the stimulus funds. One is relief, and the other is recovery. And I think likely the authority would focus more on the recovery aspect of it, so a little further down in this year. The expenses above budgets to cover costs of new procedures to be implemented to provide safe environments for patients, students, clients, and staff. If the authority were to disperse funds, we would lean towards grants to support the phasing in of operations, reopening, rehiring, and implementation of new procedures for any nonprofits that we work with. As we discussed, the way that this could be handled is that the Gopher website has a lot of resources, and I think it would be a great place for anybody participating in receiving these stimulus funds to be able to go. If we could design a simple application that will be used by all entities and all organizations, the state funds are for relief and recovery from the impact of COVID-19. It's very specific, so I think one application to cover it all would work. If there is an option to provide loans versus grants, there would likely have to be two different applications. When submitting applications, an entity would be required to disclose who they have submitted applications to, who they have received funds from, and what the funds were used for. backup documentation from the entity to support the application and request for funds. If on the Gopher website you were able to provide a list of the organizations who will be disbursing funds and the sector that each organization will be working with, I think this would help the entities so much in figuring out where they need to go quickly and easily. I also think that clear guidelines have to be in place before these funds go out so that as we get down the road a little ways, institutions are not asked to reevaluate everything they have done and return any funds that were initially eligible or believed to be eligible to be used for the response to the COVID-19 and have to return funds. I think I'll stop there. Does anybody have any questions?
Michelle, would you lead us off?
Sure. Great. Thank you. And Bonnie, thank you for your presentation and the fact that you've given this some thought about how something like this could be operationalized. We have had conversations about indirect grants coming as a recommendation from the Stakeholder Advisory Board and using entities that already exist in an ability to get the funds out quickly, efficiently, and effectively. And you're right, there should be some standardization across those various entities that might be doing that. In healthcare, we use the term no wrong door in regards to when patients access care. You don't want them to reach out for help and say, no, it's not here. You've got to go over there to the other door to get that help. And with not-for-profits, I see some of the organizations that we're looking at, whether it's HIFA, whether it's the CDFA, Charitable Foundation, and maybe even BFA because they do not-for-profit funding as well. How would you work with those other organizations to ensure that any not-for-profit reaching out for assistance doesn't go through a wrong door?
Sure, that's a great question. I think that if we could set up a clearinghouse for applications on that Gopher website where any organizations who are set up to disperse the funds would be able to report to that clearinghouse of any institutions who have submitted applications to them, and the information that would need to be provided would be obviously the name of the entity. Maybe we use the FEIN number, the amount of the request, and the use of the funds. And I think that clearinghouse would need to update daily and then provide to each of the organizations disbursing the funds a list of who has been requesting funds from which institution. And I think if a not-for-profit or is reaching out to several different organizations, that would be the time where we would contact that other organization directly and discuss whether they will do the funding or if we will do the funding. But we will make sure that hopefully it will also reduce the likelihood of duplication of funds for one particular entity. Does that answer your question, Michelle?
It does. Great. Thanks.
Thank you. Are there further questions from other members of the board?
Donnelly, we have a hand raised from Bill Artiger. Go ahead, Bill.
Thank you, Joe. Bonnie, this is an excellent presentation. I thank you very much for coming in to let us know about your direct loan programs. They're very good. I see that you've got a great list in your annual report of nonprofits who have borrowed money. If there were a program that would direct the use of COVID relief funds to help nonprofits by reducing long-term debt that they may have on their books now that drains operational resources currently, if the funds were used to reduce that debt, lower the cash flow demands, and provide then a stronger balance sheet as they came out, is HIPAA in a position to administer a grant program that would essentially be providing these funds on a grant basis, making sure that the local organization would pay off that long-term debt in a manner that reduced current cash flow needs and strengthened balance sheets? Thank you.
Thank you for your question, Bill. That is something that we would entertain with our bill, with our board, and certainly be willing to learn more about it and see if that is something that we could do. But at this point, if we can help them and if that is an avenue that we can be used to do, then we would.
Thank you.
Thank you. Further questions, Joe?
Donnelly, I don't believe we have any other hands raised from board members.
Okay, great. Thank you so much, Bonnie, for taking the time to present today. We appreciate you taking the initiative to see what we were doing and offer to help.
Thank you very much for the opportunity. And again, I want to echo some of the other folks who spoke before us and thank all of you for the time that you are putting in to try and be sure that our state gets back on its feet in the best way possible and to support as many of these entities that you possibly can. So thank you.
You're welcome. Thank you. Okay, the next item on our agenda is discussions regarding recommendations. I am hopeful that all of you had the opportunity to see that I sent you a document this morning, and then based on feedback I got from a few members, we added a couple of items, and I resent it. So hopefully everybody has the correct document in their hands. The original document, long-term care facilities, was not under healthcare, and we wanted to call that out. Thank you, Jeff. And under human services, we added developmental disabilities, just to be clear that that was something that we thought probably fell in that category rather than healthcare. This is by no means meant to reflect every sector that we can talk about. I was trying to find a way to give us a document that allowed our discussion to reflect the conversations that we've had in multiple settings, as well as information that you individually have sent to me about what your thoughts are based on priorities. I'd like to thank Bill Ardinger, whose brain works this way, and was able to work with me to put together this spreadsheet. You'll note that we did not prioritize in the typical sense. We went A through H, tried to do broad categories so that we weren't picking single businesses. We're hopeful that this format will allow all kinds of businesses to fit in these different categories, whether they're for-profit or non-profit, whether it's something in the housing realm, the healthcare realm, human services, that type of thing. We, based, again, on conversations and information provided from you as individual board members, have ranked what we believe the higher and highest priorities are, and that's an area where we can talk a little bit about timing. Based on the things that are here, I would say that what we're demonstrating is that we think those are the timing for that is get the dollars out as soon as possible. The mechanism for distribution column shows you multiple ways that we can get the money out, as, again, we've talked about, and implementing agencies. Sometimes those are also the distribution entity. And then we've put the two columns in that add other distribution sources other than CARES Act money, so that conversation we've had about have you received money from another source. And then that last column is money that has been distributed from the CARES Act funds to date. I'm sure you remember those funds that the state has received and put out for those few purposes. So with that, I would open it up for a discussion from the members. And if I look at the agenda, we did talk about, I did list here funding for support and advisory entities. You will see that in item C, and I think it also shows up in other items. And if it's not called out specifically, we do want to make sure that the entities that support people with putting their best foot forward, whether it's being able to apply, whether it's putting a business plan back together, whether it's building capacity to be able to help, building strength like the Center for Nonprofits does with nonprofits. The intention here is that those supporting entities will be included to help the distribution entities and the businesses trying to apply for funds. And then if people would comment on these other items on our item four, conditions on distributions, whether we should have them. The sector discussion, I think that's what this document shows. And then I think we'll save that last clarity on the December 31st spend compliance item for the end of our discussion. So I don't necessarily want to put everybody on the spot, but I am hopeful that people will push star 5, raise their hand, and give their feedback and input on this document as much as you're able to today. So with that, Joe, well, you know what? Actually, Bill, would you like to add anything while people are thinking?
I think, Donna Lee, you covered it very well. I would just say that obviously the legislative advocacy board has also moved down a path of trying to identify priorities and potential implementing agencies. They've actually taken the further step of trying to identify precise amounts that they would recommend for specific purposes. I think that that this spreadsheet obviously has not done that, because our members, we really haven't been discussing that in our meetings, and you haven't gotten a lot of input on that yet, because we haven't asked for it. You haven't reached out to the members for that yet. I would say that I particularly am happy that we are not putting individual size of amount or amount recommendations down, because it is important that we follow our elected officials like the governor and the members of the legislature in setting those priorities. So deferring a little bit there is fine with me at this point. But trying to get a list together, I really thank you for urging, and I was happy to help format it, but putting out something on paper that would generate discussion today.
Thanks, Bill. Really, this group has a lot of our discussion has been around the framework, the process, kind of the logic of moving forward. So with that, I will open it up. Joe, has anybody raised their hand for input?
Yes, indeed, Donna Lee. Real fast, just for members of the public, you can find both this discussion sheet that Bill just talked about on our website under the presentations, but you can also find what the Legislative Advisory Board voted on yesterday in an Excel document with their proposed allocations. That went out to board members this afternoon. I sent it out as soon as I got it, so that is on our website. And again, the members of the public trying to follow along, again, if you go to our website, we have the information there. With that, 5-star to raise your hand, and we have our first hand raised from Michelle. Go ahead, Michelle.
Great, thank you. And I don't know if this is probably a Bill question, since he's the author of this, and it's certainly our first time looking at this grid, so I'm just trying to understand what the various components mean. So you have purposes listed under each sector. Is that intended to be sort of different buckets or a grouping of types of purposes that you envision, for example, a not-for-profit could apply for? that we would then use to sort of expand maybe the Legislative Advisory Board's sort of purpose, because they had one for each sector?
I think both Bill and I could respond to that.
Sure.
So what we're trying to do is paint a broad picture. So instead of saying hair salons, you'll go here, and restaurants, you'll go there, the larger categories under those sections give some indication of what the purpose is. So let's just pick the for-profit item C, the sector, for-profit. And then it talks about loans, grants with conditions to small and mid-sized businesses with distinct needs caused by COVID. As we know, that's a requirement of the CARES Act. Then a relief BFA CAP program. So their existing program, which I've learned more about, how they operate that and who else they involve in it, but establishing something specific for this. You know, it's meant to be, you can go here no matter what your business is, if you're a for-profit business, and you can explain what your problem has been and what funds you might like. Bill, do you want to add to that a little bit more?
Yes, just as an example, if you would look, Michelle, at the sector housing security, which is E, as another example, we heard testimony on the housing sector the other day, and you could some of the information we received were recommendations for actual programs that could be operationalized quickly and distribute the money. Those included the Housing Finance Authority Rent Stabilization Program, which in Dean's written remarks had a number of very helpful details about how that rent stabilization would be maintained distinct and separate from its current rate stabilization program. It also had some other program items, some of which are listed here, so that those items under purposes are really types of program formats that we have heard about. For example, Donna Lee focused on the BFA CAP program. That program has been identified as well by the Legislative Advisory Board as a system of rules to get money out rapidly. And so, when Donna Lee was kind of talking about how can we put something on the table, the goal was to list some of the stuff we have heard and identify that it's not just housing security generally, but it would be housing security implemented through some specific distribution programs and purposes. Thank you.
So then within each one of those, we'll stay on housing security, you have some rated as highest and some as high. So does that mean the timing will be different for each one of those different programs?
Donna Lee.
Yeah, I think the timing. Go ahead, Bill.
Oh, I was just going to say on that, this is very hard. It's in the Legislative Advisory Board, they've been talking about what needs to be done right away, what needs to be done in the midterm, and what needs to be done maybe after a little bit more review of development. And this was an attempt to put on paper a rating that of highest need, higher need, and high need. And it doesn't, you could do them all. This is a discussion starter, Michelle.
Okay.
You know, what do people feel are the high, if you had to pick one, two, and three that would get the highest priority, what would they be? It's really an opener.
Okay, thank you.
You all set, Michelle?
For now, yep.
Okay, and I'm not proposing that we have to make final decision on this today. I just think I wanted to have something in place to work from. A blank sheet of paper is not the easiest thing to try to do, particularly as you've heard me say many times in our format. And we have talked about timing, whether all the money should go out right now, whether we should get some out immediately, whether we should see the results of some of that and see what's next from there. So so I think it's been discussed in both groups, as you heard the other day. Joe, do we have somebody else?
Donna Lee, I believe we have a hand raised from Dean. Go ahead, Dean.
Thank you. Thank you, Joe. Thank you, Donnelly. So I actually appreciate this framework that you and Bill put together, Donnelly. I think it actually goes towards what I think in the end of the board should be thinking is kind of our goal here, which is to establish some broad categories that we think of the resources ought to be focused on, then within those identify some specific activities that we believe have some merit and some priority, identify a potential mechanism for distributing the resources. I think I agree with Bill in the end that I don't believe that we should get too far into the weeds around specific dollar amounts, because I think in the end, in each case, assuming that Gopher and ultimately the governor accept some or all of these recommendations, there's going to need to be a lot of serious work done with the Gopher team around exactly what the parameters of a particular initiative are and what level of resources might be most immediately made available for those purposes. And also, I think Bill's point is well taken, that the Legislative Advisory Board has already done some of that thinking and some of that work, and we might want to be thoughtful about deferring to them in that context. But I can also see that as a program, if you will, is being developed further between a potential implementing entity and the Gopher staff as they understand better what the rules are and what the statutory requirements are, that the size of that program may evolve based on those facts. So getting too specific about dollar amounts at this point with this document could actually be problematic down the road.
Thanks, Dean. Appreciate your input. Joe, are there other members?
Donnelly, we have a hand raised from Jim Jobber. Go ahead, Jim.
Hi, I would agree with Bill and Dean about not getting into the weeds on the dollar amounts. I would suggest, though, that if you look through each one of these categories, we're really talking about grants, with the exception of C, which is Enterprise for Profit, where we would establish a combination of grants and loans. I am fearful that the impact of small business in the state of New Hampshire and around the country has been so significant that, and I mentioned this once in the past, that focusing on loans may really just, in the long run, not help many of these companies that have been so damaged. And the reason for that is they could borrow their way right into bankruptcy. Absent of having a really strong balance sheet and absent of having some assurance that they can get through to the other side of this thing quickly, it would cause me great concern if there wasn't more of a focus put on grants alone. And so I just think we need to think about that. Obviously, this legislative committee is going to have their thoughts on what dollar amount should be and what this should be made up of. But I think the intent of the money was really to get us through this awful situation in New Hampshire, and the intent of the money was to be the bridge, if you will. And I just don't want to see a company borrow money and not be able to repay it. So I'll leave it there for now.
Thanks, Jim. I have to tell you that I absolutely do not disagree with you. I don't think anybody carrying more debt is going to help them, particularly if they were in trouble before. But my understanding of the CAP program is it is a forgivable loan. It's like the payroll protection plan. Well, the CAP program is not like that. But when I look at the payroll protection plan and understand how that was structured from the SBA and how that works and the forgivable nature of it, I think is something that a business could easily understand. And if they follow the certain criteria and they spend it as intended, they don't pay it back. And I think that's a worthwhile thing. So
well,
I agree.
I think, Donna, the one thing about PPP, and it's, you know, Congress is rapidly trying to deal with this, is that it doesn't work for a lot of companies. And if the real struggle in this is when you start a company up and you're trying to get people to go into your restaurant door or trying to go into their shop, and they're just not going to generate enough revenue, and they're not going to be able to pay their help and pay their bills. And PPP, the way it was designed, really put a stranglehold on small business. You know, it didn't make a lot of sense when New Hampshire has a shelter-in-place rule to give money to pay people for 8 weeks. It really made sense to give money people, companies or businesses money to pay their people when they started up and extend that period out so they could start generating enough cash flow, enough revenue, so they could survive. And so I hope the mistakes of PPP will be considered as the BFA, if the BFA is in fact the intermediary that distributes funding. I hope they'll take a long, hard look at it, and I hope we can help them if need be.
Thank you, Jim. Always good to have lessons learned. And you did, I remember you mentioning that early on in our first day of presentations, asking about the difference that would make if it was extended the other direction. So thank you for putting it back on the table.
Thanks.
Further members?
Donnelly, we have a number of hands raised. Al Letizio Jr., go ahead, Al.
Thank you very much, and I just wanted to thank you, Donnelly and Bill, for the work you did in structuring this, and I appreciate the explanation of it, and, you know, I've been going through and kind of testing this chart to make sure that this fits everything that we're doing, and it looks really good. As I look at item C for the for-profit enterprises, that seems like a lot are going to roll up into that. And, for example, when we talked about the gyms and personal care, that strikes me that you had in mind that would be find its way under for-profit enterprises. Is that correct?
It is.
Okay. So when we get to, and I'm surprised I'm the first one to ask this question and not my colleague here who's the farmer, but when we talk about agriculture and farming, where do you envision that? Do you see that in the for-profit enterprises as well?
Well, I certainly think that farms would like to be profitable.
Okay,
but
so
if I think that they
about can, it as agriculture and food supply chain, I suppose, as a category.
No, I don't think we are. I think we're thinking of it as a business. If you look under C, the agricultural grant support program. You see it there? It's third one down.
Oh, okay. Oh, I'm sorry. Okay, got it.
That's okay. Oh, well, you're right. You picked the right category.
And, you know, just to echo what Jim is saying about the forgivable nature of the loans, I think it seems to me that the intent for this is with the grants to sort of fund a mandate. You know, the mandate was you got to close, and by no fault of your own, if you're out there closed and you've got all your fixed bills but you have no income because it's been shut off, it seems more fair that this would be something that provides relief versus encumbering somebody with a liability. And I know that that's what we're saying when we talk about forgivable loans, that's the security that we put along with this, using taxpayer money to say, yes, you use it the right way and it's forgivable. So in essence, it is a grant. So with that, I'll let anybody else speak. Thank you.
Thanks, Al. Joe?
Donnelly, we have a hand raised from Lisa. Go ahead, Lisa.
Thank you. First, I want to echo everyone in thanking Donnelly Bill for putting this together. It makes complete sense to me. I like the prioritization because, quite frankly, the most difficult and amorphous thing about this task of this committee to me has been how would we actually assign numbers to this? And instead, I've been trying to think of priorities. And so I think if we submit something like this, whenever we have it in its final form, once we've gone through additional sectors if necessary, that the Gopher office and the governor can put this together with what the legislative group is doing, and perhaps they will actually mesh and direct the thinking, because I wouldn't want to come in with numbers which are contrary. I think we should defer to them. So I really like this chart because to me it reflects a bottom-up approach, meaning we need to shore up things, and I've had this conversation with Donnelly, but we need to shore up things like, you know, mortgage and rent stabilization, the food supply chain, child care, so that when we take care of those things, or hopefully we do at the highest priority, as well as some small businesses, that's going to help them stay in business and, you know, then move up the food chain, if you will. So, again, I just wanted to thank you for taking the time to put this together and especially assigning the particular pass-through entities. I've learned a lot from all of you and from the presentations. So, again, thank you very much. I think it looks great so far.
You're welcome. Thank you. And thank you for all of your input. I appreciate the conversations we've had.
Thanks.
More hands up, Joe?
Donnelly, we have a number. We're going to go next to Scott. Go ahead, Scott.
Sorry. Thank you. This is a great chart, and I appreciate the work that's gone into it. Donnelly, how do you anticipate us engaging in discussion as far as setting these priorities? Are we going to have a line-by-line discussion at some point, or what's your thoughts on how to do that?
Well, as you can appreciate, and we've talked about a lot, our process is not necessarily easy, particularly, you know, you look at the legislative group and they're very accustomed to policy making, as we talked about in our joint meeting. They're also accustomed to working with each other, so their conversations, they kind of get where each other goes. For our group, it's a little bit more of a challenge. We obviously understand the sectors that some of us come from, but having that same line-by-line discussion is a bit of a challenge. What I thought about was presenting this the way that we've presented it, have discussion today. I'm sure some of you will sleep on it and think of something that you want to make sure we talk about, and then revisit it on Thursday where we could maybe find some that we agree on. If people take the time...
Hi there, this is Joe in the Go process. You know where that is? Please keep your phone.
And there's been plenty of time to shut that phone off.
Hello. So this is Joe in the Gopher office. If whoever is playing music, thank you. As a reminder to everybody, please mute your phones unless if you're speaking. Thank you.
Appreciate that. We were not looking for a brief musical interlude. Anyway, so going back to that question, Scott, so if we look down the timing priority, high, highest, higher, that list, I think it would be helpful for people between, you know, today and tomorrow to look at that and see if there are any that they would categorize differently than we've done on this first pass. And then we'll see where we land. And then we'll take it from there.
Okay.
Does that make sense?
Yep, that makes sense to me. My other question, just so I understand, when we get into potential implementing agencies, your slash marks, is that an or is it going from BFA to using RDC networks to other agencies? Or are those slashes more of an or are they?
Nope, there are. We would expect that they will be at least those and others.
Okay, so it's not that you're going to go from BFA to RDC to, okay.
Nope.
Good. The shorter the chain, the better.
Yeah. Well, and I think that, you know, some of it may very well depend on what the dollar amount is, right? So small dollar amounts might be a quick, easy thing out of one organization versus another, you know, so however that might work. And, of course, the BFA often uses banks, and having banks play a role here with their resources would be helpful too, I think.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you.
Welcome. Next, Joe.
Donnelly, we have a hand raised from Bill Ardinger. Go ahead, Bill.
Thank you, Joe. Thanks to everybody for going through this process like this. Donnelly, it takes a lot of guts for a chair to put the stuff on the table. And because in this very difficult situation where you have to meet over the phone. My comment relates to Jim's comment, which is very good about the purpose of the program is getting the money out there to businesses and other recipients like, you know, our 26 hospitals, for example, in the state. That the one concern that I want to put in the back of everyone's mind that I have is that whatever program we adopt, whether it's grant or loan, that we think about how to structure it so that the chances for fraud or waste or abuse are reduced. Nothing could harm our recovery from the COVID crisis more than structuring a program that, you know, may have the best of intent to get the money out fast, to get it out to small businesses, for example, but that it ends up, we find out that we worked so hard to get it out fast that we didn't build in protection that protect the value of these funds for the good of our state and our residents. I just wanted to raise that concern that I'm struggling with and get it on the table to the group. Thank you.
Thanks, Bill. I appreciate it. I think that you know, part of that is the double dip conversation that we've been having, and some of it is the Shake Shack Lakers discussion, in shorthand pointed out.
Absolutely,
we talked about.
Dolly, you put your finger right on it. It's that kind of stuff that I think has undermined public faith in recovery and relief efforts, and I just hope that we can urge the Gopher team and the governor and the legislative branch not to make those mistakes to the extent we can avoid
it. I agree. It's funny, Dean Christian and I both remembered Edna Pearl Parr from the legislature back in the day, like way back in the late 70s, early 80s, and she used to say, well, folks, just want to be making sure we're helping the needy and not the greedy. And, you know, actually, I think we all want to be careful about that. With all due respect, I'm not interested in supporting a business that maybe last year made 15% in profit, and then this year it looks like they're only going to make 3%. I don't think it's our responsibility with these kinds of dollars to try to make up their 12% loss in profit. Rather than these businesses that we're trying to say, due to no fault of your own, we closed you, and now, you know, you have no margin of profit, even close to being possible until we can make you whole. I think all of us feel that way based on the conversations we've been having. Joe, next on the phone, anybody?
Donnelly, we have a growing list, which is great. Again, five-star. we're going to go next to Ben. Go ahead, Ben.
Thanks, Joe, and thanks, Donna Lee. I agree with all the other comments on this format. I think this is, when I first got a glance at it, it really helped put things into perspective, similar to the legislative chart that was put together. And Scott raised my first question, which was how we saw the how we're going to prioritize this list, and any thoughts on that process. And I think you answered that by saying you wanted input from each of us on highest versus high, with highest, I'm assuming, being we want to get the funds out right away. Couple other observations, that some of which have been shared already. On the profit category, I think the comment was made that that's a pretty huge bucket of different sectors that sort of all fall into that bucket. And so we may want to think about that. I know the tourism market is the second largest industry in the state as far as collective. So just making sure that there's some definition there. And I thought it was really interesting, Bonnie's presentation from New Hampshire Health and Education. She had made a suggestion that potentially the Gopher site could be a sort of a conduit for the intermediaries. So I get a lot of questions on a daily basis about, well, who do we talk to for that funding source and how, you know, where's the branch? And I thought that was a great suggestion. And so when we do prioritize these and when that process gets moving, I just thought that was worth noting. And totally second Jim Jalbert's comments about the funds being grants and if loans forgivable. I've talked to so many businesses that are not going to recover from this. And this is recovery money more than stability money, I think. And Bill, your comments right on, just making sure it's all done in a sound fashion. So just observations, a lot of which was covered already, but hopefully we can get the priorities straight. That'd be great. Thank you.
Thanks, Ben. Joe?
We have a question from Nancy. Go ahead, Nancy.
Here we go. A lot of what I was going to talk about has been covered. I really appreciate the framework. It really is helpful, and it sort of makes me want to go back and look at some of the prior testimony as well and see if there's anything else that we might want to include in the list. The presentations that we had from the funders in the for-profit column, they both talked about targeted grant support. So I think that is sort of included in their thinking already, which is, I hear that from several other people on the line. So it's important to me as well. My one question had to do with the, in the nonprofit category, I think we're very specific on the food bank and legal assistance. I'm a little concerned that maybe our economic support grants for nonprofits, that's going to be a mighty big pool. I mean, there are a broad range of needs in there. So that was, I think, one thing I just wanted to throw into the conversation, whether we needed to break that out at all or not.
You mean the fourth one under?
The third one, economic support grants with conditions. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, there's just such a broad group of nonprofits and needs, and everything from arts organizations to, you know, small groups that do all kinds of important things in our communities. So that I think that's it for me. I really agree with others. I thought that Bonnie's comments on that. Conduit concept. I really like that as well. So that's it for me.
Okay, thanks. You know, Nancy, the point that you just made about wanting to go back and look at testimony, I can actually really understand why you would say that. I think one of the lenses that would be helpful to use when, you know, looking at this list again is to say, I'm concerned about X group, whatever it is, because I thought about the arts as well. And would they fall under one of these categories that we've described? And if so, how do we make sure that there's funding enough to take care of it? And I think funding at different levels makes a difference too, because some organizations, you know, $20,000 could make all the difference in the world to them. And others, unless it's $200,000, they don't even want to ask,
right?
Because they know how big it is. So I think that's a good lens for the board members to use when looking at this list as well. Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Joe?
Donnelly, we have a few more hands. And the next hand raised was Amy LaBelle. Go ahead, Amy.
Good afternoon. My question is relative to the for-profit business section of the grid. And if anyone has a kind of a ballpark number of the for-profit businesses in the state, I'm curious, you know, I know there's going to be a lot of need, and what would that $100,000 look like if, you know, 80% of the businesses apply for it? Thank you.
What, Amy, what do you mean the $100,000?
I'm just looking at the grid, and it looks as though the legislative board was recommending $100 million to be set aside. I'm just, you know, looking at the relative categories and wondering how to best use this money to make impacts. And if anyone had a sense of how many businesses would be applying, you know, both on the nonprofit, as I think Nancy touched on, as well as in the for-profit areas, you know, if that $100 million is going to be split among, I don't know, 10,000 businesses or et cetera.
I get it now. You threw me when you said 100,000. I think you meant the $100 million that you
I meant 100
said.
Million.
That's okay. I'm like, geez, did somebody put 100? Okay. Yeah, I think we do know the number of businesses in the state, small, medium, and large, actually. I'm trying to recall if that was in the BFA paperwork or the REDC responses, but I'll take a look for where we can get that information. I'll try to send it out to everybody today if I can find an answer.
Thank you, Donnelly.
You're welcome. Joe?
Donnelly, we have a hand raised from Holly. Go ahead, Holly.
Thank you. I just wanted to throw in my support. I really like the template and the rankings that they've been identified. I think they put the focus on life safety, and I think those do deserve the highest priority. I have a question on Section C, where it talks about loans and grants to small and mid-size. Nowhere does it mention larger size businesses, and are they going to be eligible for funding? And the other question is just looking at a sector that I wasn't quite sure if they would fall under not-for-profit would be animal welfare. And I would assume that would probably go under not-for-profit.
I think it would if they were a not-for-profit, but if they're, let's say, a veterinary office that's a for-profit, they'd fall in the other category.
And then the larger size businesses?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think we just most of the responses that I've gotten for people were focused on small and mid-size. So I think if you're a large business, and as I used the example earlier, you're for-profit and you're losing money, I don't see why you wouldn't apply. And that loss of money means real money, not loss of profit.
Right, right, related to COVID.
Right, exactly.
Right.
Good catch. Thank you.
Thank you.
Joe?
Donnelly, we have a question from Lisa. Go ahead, Lisa.
Oh, I'm sorry. I actually did not have a question. I think I pressed the wrong button. My apologies.
Well, as soon as we're perfect, we won't need a human race anymore.
Donnelly, we have a hand raise from Jim Jalbert. Go ahead, Jim.
Thank you, Joe. I wanted to discuss real briefly or comment on what Bill said about fraud. I think one of the things with and bring back PPP for a second, one of the problems with PPP was the onus was put more on the applicant rather than the lender in the process of applying and getting the loan, and I think that's where some of the problems came from. I think whether you're for-profit or not-for-profit, one of our challenges has to be the process in terms of what the application requires. In the financial reporting, you know, hopefully current financial statements, current tax returns, all of that would play a role in separating a good applicant or a viable applicant from someone who's not. The second thing is, if we involve intermediaries, and Donnelly, you had that I'm looking at administrative costs of distribution. If we involve intermediaries, they have to be reimbursed for their costs, especially if it's a state agency. And I am fearful that some of these agencies who try to do this, it's really going to, as it's caught. I sit on a community bank board, and I can tell you that the costs associated with PPP were significant, and given what they were out of the gate paying lenders to process PPP, it was a losing situation. So, good record keeping, good financials, coupled with a sound process makes a lot of sense. And finally, Donnelly, you did an amazing job putting this out on the table, and Bill, thanks for your assistance. Clearly, this is the direction we need to go in.
Thank you. Okay, what does the board look like, Joe? Yep.
Donnelly, we have a hand raised from Michelle. Go ahead, Michelle.
Hi, thank you. Just a question, maybe it's a process question, and I'm speaking specifically to healthcare, because obviously we didn't hear them until today, and these categories were put together, or these purposes and their ranking was put together prior to hearing them today. So what would be the process to readdress these? I mean, we heard, federal funding is only probably going to cover a third of the losses of the hospitals. I see this ranked as higher rather than highest, which means later, and I'm just concerned about the timing of that. So just can you recommend what process I should take so that we could address this? I mean, I hear you're going to talk about it Thursday, but do you want comments in advance? How would
I
you
do.
Like to handle it?
I do. Okay. I would love everybody to send me, and again, not as a group because we can't conduct business that way, but information that you send me with your thoughts about this grid, your thoughts about what level of priority, your thoughts about, Michelle, I think you're saying much the same as Nancy. Go back, look at some of this testimony. I have spent some time reading some of the things that have been posted before today from both the legislative board as well as the packet that went out for today's meeting. But any adjustments that any of you see, please, by all means, let me know, and we'll add it to Thursday's discussion as we try to, get our arms around this and get something out the door.
Great. And then what about comments and ideas about sort of the intermediaries, I guess we'll call them? I agree with Jim Jobber, I think, who's just speaking about, PPP probably didn't pay the banks enough, because I'm also on a community bank board, but at least they had a standard, a minimum, and then based on size, there was a percentage so that it didn't matter what agency it went through, everybody was getting compensated something similarly. The application, I would think that would be a gopher work product, but, I mean, how far down do you want us to go into these different thoughts and considerations?
Well, I mean, I think to some degree we get in the weeds enough to understand it so we can make good decisions. But as I like to say, I try not to get in the weeds so deep that I need floss to get the bugs out of my teeth, if you know what I mean. So I do think that there's a division of where we end and Gopher picks up. But I do think that us saying that there should be standards around that, just like conditions on the application, I think it's well within our role to advise as it relates to things like that. These are the things we want to make sure are considered in every application. This is the way we think we should manage the costs of the entities that are distributing, whether it's a state agency that has a cost associated with it because their work is still ongoing. How do we do that so we make sure that it's reasonable and fair without being, like if you say to somebody, oh, your rate can't exceed, 10%, and they're distributing $200 million, I think the world would be like, are you kidding me that it's going to take $20 million to? So I think we can make recommendations in a broad sense about what our concerns are, and then I think the responsibility to take it to that next step is more likely the Gopher staff. And if I'm wrong, I'm sure I will hear about it between now and Thursday. And I will let you know of any mistakes I've made in declaring that.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Donnelly, we have a hand raised from Scott Mason. Go ahead, Scott.
Thank you. One of the things I kind of missed when I was first looking at this is column D, timing slash priority. We were having discussions before about timing of funding, and I'm not sure, I don't remember us actually finishing it up, but should we be timing funding to go along with the reopening? You know, there may be some money that needs to be made available to go along with the reopening of the state and bringing people back. And then also we talked about timing in more of a, you know, we'll spend 60% of the funds the first go around and then do a second go around, reevaluate, do a second go around, reevaluate, and finish up with a final go around. Should we split this timing and priority column into two separate columns so that we can have a discussion about timing and a discussion about priority of the funding?
Well, there's no reason that we couldn't.
Complicated.
Well, I was heading that way. Like you see some of the things that I provide to you. It's just a stream of thought for me, you know,
yeah.
My own questions, right? I think we all do that, but I have to embarrassingly put mine out there to try to help us move forward from meeting to meeting. And so initially, you know, one of the things that we talked about was, should we time it with the reopening? So the hair salons, you know, some of those things, you know, as the governor's task force is making recommendations and he's making decisions. But then I thought, that's making it a little complicated. If we create the categories like we've done on this spreadsheet and they're up and ready to go, and it will be obvious, I think, to some degree, or it could be a recommendation that, you know, the first ones, you know, in the application, one of the first things we want to make sure that we ask is, you know, are you open, right? So maybe you're an essential business. Are you opening in the next, you know, 14 days, 30 days, you know, however we want to phrase that question on the application, which would allow the entities responsible for the distribution and processing the applications, they could look at them in that way. Who needs it right now because they're opening? Or who's going to close tomorrow because they don't have it and won't be able to open? So I think we could, we certainly can talk more about it, but that was kind of my frame of reference on why I thought this category might be right.
As a committee, should we discuss it and make a decision on where we think priorities should be as far as timing? Or should we just stick with priorities as far as what we think is the most important thing to get accomplished?
I think that from now until, let's say, close a business tomorrow, when everybody's had a chance to really look at this more closely and think it through, I think that will become evident to people. And any of you that think that we should do it differently or consider something else, I would appreciate knowing ahead of time so I can put it out there for conversation. Or I can say, you know, 14 of you told me that you want to not split it in two. You want to focus on, you know, the urgency of getting money out right away, and the timing can be part of the application. You know, let me know whatever that is, and I'll report back. Does that help
at
all, Scott? You're welcome.
Donnelly, we have a hand raised from Dean.
Actually, Joe, Donnelly's comments have addressed what I was going to ask or suggest, and so I am fine. Thank you.
Donnelly, we appear to not have any hands raised. We had a long list, but
right.
there, does not appear to be further hand raised.
Well, thank you, everybody. I know that we've all put a lot of thought into this, and we've also all done a lot of reading, and we've also all had a lot of conversations with people that call us when they know the role that we're playing in some of this. And so that's part of what has, informed this document that you have today. As I said earlier, it's by no means the end of the conversation, and I would really appreciate you taking the time to think it through. And, the sooner you can get comments to me, between today and tomorrow, the better, because then I can get out a revised document to people for a robust discussion on Thursday about where we go from there. The last item under the regarding recommendations is the clarity on the December 31st, 2020 spend compliance. Instead of taking that up, we did talk about it a little bit before. Joe, could you ask on your team if somebody could really look into that for us and tell us just how clear it is versus not? Because I think that is important to know as well, not necessarily for what we're doing right now, but for the application and for the people getting the money. I think they're going to want to know, have a better understanding of that. Could you maybe look at doing that so that we can get an update if you can have it by Thursday? And if not, we'll just keep it on our list. Does that make sense?
Absolutely. So I can ask if Nancy Smith could join us Thursday. I just want to make sure that I want to make sure that I'm able to communicate effectively to Nancy to make sure that we address your concerns. So specifically, if you could just help me, what is it that you would like for Gopher to present to the board relative
to
that?
There's been a few conversations around what that December 31st deadline means as far as spend. So some people have said that it means that if the money has been given to business X, by December 31st, that's considered spent, and, how they finish spending it within their business, as long as it meets the compliance, that's not a problem. Others have said, no, it needs to be out and spent by the recipient by December 31st. It's that kind of conversation that I want to have a better sense on, and we may not have better guidance, and it might be one of those things that comes out, a little further down the road here in the next couple of weeks. I don't really know. But wherever we are, and if there's a difference of opinion, I appreciate Attorney Smith's opinion, but I also know that sometimes more than one lawyer can think about something differently. Imagine that if we could. So I just want to kind of know what's in the mix.
Absolutely. I'll have a conversation with Nancy. And fortunately, we have a bunch of lawyers here on staff, so I'm always very careful what I say.
Careful.
So,
just
yep,
saying, I like lawyers. Some of my best friends are lawyers.
And, so.
All right. So you know what I'm asking. I'd appreciate it.
Absolutely. Thank you. I just wanted to make sure so that I can, and so the board knows for Thursday. So we will get on that.
Thank you. Fair enough. Okay. Other discussion under item 4? Anybody? Okay. I'm not aware of any other business unless somebody has some. We'll give it 30 seconds, I think, is what it takes to raise your hand.
Donnelly, we don't appear to have any
hands raised. All right. Our next meeting is Thursday at 2 p.m. Agriculture will be on the agenda. I'd like to thank Scott Mason for working on getting that ready. And as I've put on the agenda, we're anticipated on May 19th, tourism and hospitality. And Ben is working on that. I know he's reached out to Al, and if there's anybody else that from the board that wants to touch base with Ben with any ideas, I'm sure he will welcome them. Friendly reminder that we want to keep the you know, presentations to that 15 minutes apiece window and enough time to do some of our work after. So with that, if there's nothing else, I'd like to thank everybody for a very robust discussion today. It's very helpful. Thank you.
Thank you, Donnelly.
Thank you, Donnelly.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, and thank you for joining a duly noticed meeting for the Stakeholder Advisory Board to the Governor's Office of Emergency Relief and Recovery. This meeting has been conducted in a manner compliant with RSA 91A and has been recorded. We will stop the recording at 3:43 p.m. Thank you very much for your time.